This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and hello to all of you rationalists and freethinkers. There's a lot of us out there, so if you feel alone, know that we're now probably one in five Americans identifying as non-religious.
And I'm Dan Barker, your co-host of Freethought Radio. I'm your friendly neighborhood atheist of the airwaves. This is the October 27th, 2012 broadcast of Free Thought Radio. We produce and broadcast in Madison, Wisconsin. We also broadcast in a number of other cities, including Columbia, Missouri, Ithaca, New York, Monterey, Grand Rapids, and other places. And of course, we podcast.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Watchdog, State Church Watchdog Organization, FFRF, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which I co-founded with my mother. There were two of us back in 1976, and we've grown to well over 19,000 members today, in members in every state and every province, and we're the largest atheist agnostic membership organization in North America.
Working to keep state and church separate. Today, October 27th, is the birthday of Niccolo Paganini, who was born in 1782. The virtuoso Italian violinist and composer lived a completely religion-free life. He refused the sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church on his deathbed, and there was no religious ritual at his burial. Even his religious biographer admitted that Paganini was religiously indifferent. So listen for some of Paganini's music during today's show. And Annie Laurie, on your birthday next week, you're going to be not at home. You're going to be in Mexico City.
Yeah, my first visit to Mexico City. And Dan, you're going to have to tell me how to actually say this in Spanish. It's the second Mexican Atheist Conference.
El segundo coloquio mexicano de ateísmo.
And my talk is going to be God Fixation Won't Fix Any Nation. I'll say that in Spanish.
And on their webpage, they have your talk titled, La Obsesión con Dios Nunca Arreglará Una Nación.
Now, about the only thing I know how to say in Spanish is, I think, a good thing to say in Spanish, and I'm kind of envious of the Spanish language because they can say this in three little words, adios, adios.
Which means goodbye to God. They're talking about making that a billboard in Mexico City.
Well, that would be perfect.
Adios, adios.
And who's our guest today?
Well, our guest on today's show, since this is Halloween week, it's appropriate that we will talk about a monster. No, not Frankenstein, the Founderstein monster. And we'll tell you more about what that means. Today, we're going to talk with Michael Austin. He's the author of the new book, That's Not What They Meant, about the way the religious right has been distorting and cherry-picking the quotes and the views of America's founding fathers.
Now, talk about the religious right distorting the views of the founding fathers. Last week, we talked about FFRF's big fufara in the little community of Kuntz, Texas, where the cheerleaders are holding up giant paper banners with scripture verses on them during public school football games. And as a result of our complaint, the district said, don't do that. And now the cheerleaders are suing the district, and they got a temporary injunction against the school district. But the Freedom From Religion Foundation is getting some major players on our side, and we want to read some of these editorials by national newspapers that are the voice of reason. And I'm going to start with the Washington Post, which on October 23rd published an editorial with a cute title, Bench the Bible Verses. And here's the editorial. Imagine you're in the stand at high school football games and the cheerleaders hoist a paper banner painted with the Bible verse, I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me. The football team then runs through the sign to start play. With whom would you think the religious message was associated? The school-sponsored cheerleading squad holding the sign and lined up around it? Obviously. The school-sponsored football team? Probably. The school administrators who allow the banner prime space in a pregame ritual? Maybe. Surely not just the individual cheerleaders who painted the sign. Yet, that is what the parents of 15 Koontz High School cheerleaders in Koontz, Texas claim you should think. They argued that their daughters are simply expressing their private views on the football field when the school's cheerleading squad raises its run-through banners, one of which reads, "If God is for us, who can be against us?" or "Thanks be to God, which gives us victory through our Lord Jesus Christ." After school district administrators banned the religiously themed banners, the cheerleaders' parents sued in state court, and a judge granted an injunction last week that allows the girls to continue displaying the sign. The dispute is turning national. The Wisconsin-based Freedom from Religion Foundation is now looking for a Koontz plaintiff to sue in federal court. Texas Governor Rick Perry has weighed in unhelpfully. "We're a nation that's built on the concept of free expression of ideas," he said, according to the New York Times. "We're also a culture built upon the concept that the original law is God's law outlined in the Ten Commandments." The Washington Post editorial goes on to say, "And if a student in the stand doesn't believe that, or an aspiring cheerleader happens to be a Hindu, or a wide receiver is a Christian who is offended by the notion that God cares about the outcome of a high school football game, the cheerleaders' backers say that the school doesn't have any policy that implies endorsement of the banner's content, and that students, even cheerleaders, who disagree with it are not required to participate in anything banner-related. Yet the cheerleading squad is a campus organization with faculty oversight, and it represents the school, wears its uniform, and occupies a privileged space on the playing field. Its banners are part of a pregame ritual that involves the football players, for whom the school buys uniforms and provides other kinds of support. Since the squad and the team carry the school's imprint, students should not have to choose between tacitly endorsing a sectarian message and participating in a cheerleading routine or taking the field with their teammates. Likewise, spectators shouldn't have to choose between cheering on their team and avoiding the cheerleaders' proselytizing." The Washington Post ends their editorial. "The case is headed to a trial in Texas court with the possibility of a federal case later. But it would be better for the cheerleading squad, the football team, and the community they represent if the cheerleaders would drop their suit, stick to messages that are more inclusive, and practice and preach their religion in a more appropriate setting." So thank you, Washington Post.
And now from the New York Times, I'll just excerpt it because it repeats a lot of this. The New York Times editorialized on October 21st. "To the school's cheerleaders," and the title of the editorial is "Faith, Football, and the First Amendment. To the school's cheerleaders, the banners are personal statements sharing messages of inspiration. They say they're a form of free speech and religious expression protected by Texas Constitution. But under a 2000 Supreme Court ruling in a Texas case, this kind of religious display at public school events clearly violates the First Amendment. They're not merely personal expressions of belief, but in that setting become religious messages endorsed by the school district, and the local government." Justice John Paul Stevens wrote for the majority in that 2000 case, "The choice between whether to attend these games or to risk facing a personally offensive religious ritual is in no practical sense an easy one. The Constitution," he said, "demands that the school may not force this difficult choice upon these students." Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott intervened to support the cheerleaders, and Governor Rick Perry endorsed the move. "If you think about it," the governor said, "the Koontz cheerleaders simply wanted to call a little attention to their faith in their Lord. These officials are blind to the dangers to religious freedom when government shifts from being neutral about religion to favoring a particular one. This problem is prevalent all over Texas." As Justice Stevens said, "One of the purposes served by the Establishment Clause is to remove debate over this kind of issue from governmental supervision or control, to avoid the dangers of a union between church and state. In this country, including in Texas, the Constitution does not leave religious freedom up to majority rule." That's the New York Times.
And then there was a commentary in the USA Today last week by Ken Paulson, who's president of the First Amendment Center in Nashville. And he also editorialized. He said that it's an odd system when a reference to Jesus is considered religious and a reference to God is not. The safest course for all public schools is to call for a moment of silence before a game. He's editorializing against the banners and against religion in the schools. So hopefully reason will prevail. And I'm Annie Laura Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker.
What are we listening to?
A little bit of Paganini's Caprice number 24, the free-thinking composer. And stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio. We're going to be talking later in the show with the author of the book, That's Not What They Meant.
Well, and coming up is the debut of your new song, co-written with a famous collaborator, Charles Strauss, composer of Annie.
So stay tuned.
So that'll be in the next segment.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
Little girls, everywhere I turn. I can see them. Little girls, night and day I eat, sleep, and breathe them. I'm an ordinary woman with feelings. I'd like a man to nibble on my ear, but I'll admit, no man has bit. So how come I'm the mother of the year?
And that's Carol Burnett singing the song Little Girls from the movie Annie. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and that musical Annie is being revived on Broadway. And what's that got to do with Free Thought? Well, lyrics are by Martin Sharnan and the music by Charles Strauss. And Charles accepted the Emperor Has No Clothes Award as a publicly known atheist at FFRF's 34th Annual Convention in Hartford, Connecticut last year, and he and Dan have collaborated on a new song that in a couple minutes we are going to debut on Free Thought Radio, and it's fabulous.
But first, listen to a little bit of Charles Strauss's acceptance speech at our convention last year.
I'm overwhelmed, and I truly mean this. My beliefs were something I've always kept to myself for no particular reason, and I never knew there were a group of people that were not only agreeing with me, but doing something about it. I've never been an activist of any sort, and I'm very proud that you all share my view, and I don't know what else to say except what I've done is prepare a couple of songs that I'd like to do for you tonight, okay? Thank you. I never thought that atheists made speeches, and I am certainly surprised to have been asked to. I became an atheist when my sister died at age 40, and when a rabbi said to us, God, in his mysterious wisdom, has chosen to take this girl, that kind of clinched it for me. But I was headed that way for a long time. I had tested God in my childhood prayers. He never took it out on me. I am a composer. I never got to serve in the armed forces, but was made quite aware then that there are no atheists in foxholes, a very powerful statement to me at the time. Years later, it occurred to me that if everyone was an atheist, there mightn't be any foxholes. So, broken wrist and all, I'm going to struggle for this and play a few songs. Thank you. I didn't know such a society existed. I thought it was just a very private thing that I believed in. I mean, half of the people that were mentioned, people in my profession who were atheists, I had no idea. I had met Irving Berlin once, Rogers once. Obviously, it was never spoken about. And it's nice to know they're such wonderful company. my first show on Broadway, which people account as, you know, the beginning of life, like Adam and Eve, Broadway, was by my birdie. Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face, brush off the clouds and cheer up, put on a happy face. Take off that gloomy mask of tragedy, it's not your style. You look so good that you'll be glad you decided to smile.
And that song, Put on a Happy Face, that was sung by Dick Van Dyke in the movie Bye Bye Birdie, is also the title of Charles Strauss's autobiography, where he admits and comes out as a non-believer.
Now, what you may not know is that before he came up to the stage to accept that award, we had dinner, and during dinner, he was beaming with his wife, looking around the room full of atheists, and he says, Dan, I've never written a song about belief or non-belief. Why don't you send me some lyrics, and I'll set them to music? So I did, and he did.
And you debuted that song at the Portland Convention, and we have this rough mix. It's not the final mix. The radio debut of Poor Little Me, written by Charles Strauss and Dan Barker.
The multitudes mumble mythologies without end. But me, I have trouble with ologies that pretend to show what can't be shown, to know what can't be known. Lutherans have liturgies, Calvinists have creeds, Muslims have their minarets, Catholics have their beads, Methodists have methods, holy truth to ascertain, but poor little me, I only have a brain. Bishops transubstantiate, Shintos ring their bells, transcendentalists meditate, while Wiccans weave their spells. Hindus chant a mantra when they can't relieve the pain, but poor little me, I only have a brain. So fearful of the Netherland, believers band together. Unhappy with the weatherman, the Zunis wave a feather. They dance in circles to demand great spirits send some rain. But what do you do if you only have a brain? Quakers quake and Shakers shake, and Jews eat kosher food. Rastafarians wear their hair in pious gratitude. They all boast of miracles that no one can explain, but poor little me, I only have a brain. Send some rain, but what do you do if you only have a brain? Quakers quake and Shakers shake, and Jews eat kosher food. Rastafarians wear their hair in pious gratitude. They all boast of miracles that no one can explain, but poor little me, poor little me, I own. A brain.
That is the rough mix of Poor Little Me, a new song, a collaboration between Dan Barker and Charles Strauss, composer of Annie.
Stay tuned to Free Thought Radio. After the break, we'll be talking with the author of the book, That's Not What They Meant, Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from America's Right Wing. His name is Michael Austin. I'm Dan Barker, and here with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio. Welcome back to Radio as Secular as Our Constitution. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is Free Thought Radio. Dan and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. That, of course, was Gershwin's Ain't Necessarily So.
Annie Laurie and I are both reading a number of good books. We're always reading like 10 books at a time right now, and we've been talking about them. And when I told her that I found an author who will be a great guest for today's show, she asked, "What book is that?" And I said, "It's the Founderstein book." And she said, "Oh, yes, great."
In our work, we're always dealing with the religious right trying to claim we are a Christian nation, quoting or misquoting all these views of the Founding Fathers that seem to support their position.
Our guest today, the author of this new book, is called That's Not What They Meant, Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from America's Right Wing, has clearly and decisively countered these often bogus or slanted or out of context spurious quotations by these modern theocrats who desperately want to make it appear that the founders of our country thought exactly like they think. Dr. Michael Austin is provost and vice president for academic affairs at Newman University. He'll be talking to us from the Kansas campus. He received a PhD in English literature from UC Santa Barbara. He served variously as professor of English, chair of the Department of English, and dean of graduate studies at Shepherd University. That's in West Virginia. He joined Newman University as provost and professor in 2008. He currently writes about American history, contemporary issues. He has a blog called the Founderstein Blog. Michael Austin has authored a number of books, including the textbook, Reading the World, Ideas That Matter. And his most recent book, which we just talked about, just came out this month, That's Not What They Meant, Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from the American Right. We have with us on the phone from Kansas, Michael Austin. So welcome to Free Thought Radio.
Thank you very much, Dan.
And Michael, what do you mean by Founderstein or Founderstein?
Founderstein is my name for a mythical creation of people on all sides of the political spectrum, but right now we see it most on the right wing. And that is a group of founding fathers who had collective opinions about things. A group of wise patriots who all agreed with each other and can be asserted as really a battering ram for your opponents. So whenever you hear somebody saying the founding fathers believed, quote, the Founding Fathers said, the Founding Fathers would have rejected, that's almost always a Founderstein, because it's almost certain that some Founding Fathers would agree with the statement that comes next, and some would have disagreed with it.
Well, we hear that a lot from like Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck and a lot of these right-wing people trying to argue for their point of view.
They're kind of the heroes of the book.
Yeah.
In a not very heroic sort of way.
Anti-heroes.
Yes. They're the protagonists of the work.
So there was no Founderstein.
Well, the Founding Fathers, however we choose to define the Founding Fathers, and there are lots of different definitions that we can use. Normally it means anybody who was alive in 1776 or so and didn't side with the British. But however we choose to define it, there is almost nothing upon which they agreed, except maybe that that we would be better off governed by ourselves than by the British. But they certainly didn't all agree about the Constitution. They didn't agree that we should have a Constitution. They didn't agree about who should be more powerful, the state or the federal government. They didn't agree with whether or not the federal government should be limited to a certain number of clearly enumerated powers in the Constitution. That was a huge area of disagreement. And they certainly didn't agree about much religiously.
And at the Constitutional Convention, what were there, 80 that were there? And they, some of them refused to sign. Some of them did not sign it.
There were 55 people at the Constitutional Convention, 39 of whom signed.
Wow, okay. So some of them walked away without agreeing.
Yes. A number of them walked away, largely on the issue of state power. Most of them felt that the Constitution gave too much power to the federal government, and they really were looking for something more like the Articles of Confederation.
Which were pretty disastrous.
Which really would have created 13 autonomous states in a loose affiliation, something like the European Commonwealth is today.
Something like what Rick Perry wants Texas to be today, right?
Something like what, yeah. And, you know, Rick Perry's book, Fed Up, was one of my primary sources because he makes a lot of claims about what the founders meant to do, or the framers of the Constitution meant to do with federal and state governments. And some framers did want that. Some of the people who didn't sign the original Constitution were in favor of a very empowered state and a very weak federal government. That was not the consensus of most of the delegates there.
Well, one thing that seemed to be the consensus is they weren't interested in praying at the Constitutional Convention.
Yes, they...
They did not formally pray.
Well, Franklin did call for prayer, but nobody voted on it, right?
There was one instance where Franklin, and when Franklin was in his 80s there, he was lying down most of the time, and he didn't say that much. There was one time where he said, let's all pray that we can get along, and they all prayed. But that was not an institutionalized part of the convention.
And so the framers of the Constitution really can be distinguished from the founders you're talking about.
Well, there's no definition of founders or founding fathers or founding parents, and there are hundreds of people that you can group into that category or not group into that category, depending on how you want to define the term. The framers really are limited to the 55 men who attended the convention. You may want to limit them to the 39 who signed the document, but really all 55 had input into the Constitution. So those are really the only two possible definitions of the framers of the Constitution.
So was Patrick Henry, he wasn't at the convention, but he gets quoted a lot. Was he a founder?
Patrick Henry actually refused to attend the convention. He said he was actually elected to attend the convention. He said he was not going to go because he smelled a rat, and it was a rat that tended towards monarchy. So he refused to attend, and he fought vigorously against the Constitution during the period where it was debated.
Now, one of the things I like about your book, there's a lot of good things in here that I think most freethinkers working like we work would appreciate. But when you talk about Rick Perry making the argument that local governments know better how to rule than some big overcloud federal government, you know, and that very issue was debated back then by many of the founding fathers, I'm using that phrase, who went back and forth on it. And in fact, many of them thought that a stronger federal government granted greater protection over the freedoms of conscience of the people.
Very much. And this was Madison's main point in Federalist Number 10, which is probably the most famous, and in my opinion, the best of the Federalist Papers. What Madison says is that you have, in any community, you have factions, and that's part of human nature. People are going to disagree. And the greatest danger to a democracy or a republic, the greatest danger to the kind of government that they were setting up, was that a faction would become a permanent majority and would then begin to invade the rights of other people. Whether this is a religious or an ethnic or any other kind of majority, the idea of a permanent faction or a permanent majority was what scared Madison the most. And he said the only way to avoid this is to concentrate sufficient power in a centralized government to prevent at the federal level, at the national level, the formation of a permanent majority. And he said this specifically because states became very oppressive. When there was a majority in the state that felt one way, they tended in his era, and I think tend today, to become very oppressive towards the people who are not part of that permanent faction, that permanent majority faction, and to take away their rights. Now, of course, what's underwriting all of this is the debate over slavery. And one, you know, so much of slavery is the 8-million-pound gorilla in the Constitutional Convention. We don't ever read the word in the Constitution, but there are very few clauses where it's not undergirding everything that's being said. And slavery is one of your classic examples of a small minority or even a larger minority within a state being completely oppressed and deprived of all civil and human rights by a permanent majority faction.
So the ultimate states' rights issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
We are at the breaking point. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker.
We are speaking with That's Not What They Meant, Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from America's Right Wing, Michael Austin, and we'll be back to talk about, have Michael give us some examples of how theocrats use these spurious, out-of-context quotes from the Founding Fathers.
And this is a little bit of spooky Mormon hell, because it's Halloween week, and we're talking about a monster called Founderstein. So stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And we're continuing our talk with Michael Austin. He's the author of a brand new book, just came out this month, called That's Not What They Meant. The subtitle is Reclaiming the Founding Fathers from America's Right Wing. And Michael, what are some examples of how the Glenn Becks and Sean Hannitys and Governor Perrys of the world, of how they are misusing or misquoting some of our founders?
Well, I think that the central mistake or the central manipulation that I talk about in the book, the Founderstein, the collectivizing of opinion, leads to some very dishonest chains of reasoning and chains of quotation, because you can always quote half of a debate as if it were everybody's opinion. And as long as all of your founding fathers can be merged together into a collective, then you can quote Patrick Henry and make that the opinion of the founders. So Patrick Henry said a lot of things about establishing Christianity in Virginia and also in the United States. And one of the reasons he opposed the Constitution was because it didn't do that. So you go back, and you know, the great debate about separation of church and state was not around the Constitution. It was not even a particularly important issue when the Constitution was being created. It was 3 years earlier in Virginia, when Patrick Henry offered a bill that would have levied a non-denominational tax to support all Christian religions, not Catholicism, but all Protestant denominations would have received money from this tax. And James Madison stepped up and opposed it vigorously. And in his opposition, which is called the Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Establishment in Virginia, he laid out the case for government non-cognizance of religion. And let me give you a little quote. I pulled out a couple of quotes from William J. Federer's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations, which is just a whole lot of completely non-contextualized proof texts about making the assertion that America ought to be and was always intended to be a religious country. So here is Madison saying, and I quote, "Before any man can be considered as a member of civil society, he must be considered as a subject of the governor of the universe. And if a member of civil society do it with the saving of his allegiance to the universal sovereign." You end the quote there, and you can kind of make a case that Madison was very religious and believed that everybody had to be religious, and that was kind of a precursor of citizenship in Virginia or in the United States. If you just go to the next thing he says, the next sentence of that quotation, "We maintain, therefore, that in matters of religion, no man's right is abridged by the institution of civil society, and that religion is wholly exempt from its cognizance." This is where Madison begins to lay out his view of the government non-cognizance of religion, that because religious devotion to God is something that one negotiates before negotiating a social contract, government can take no notice of religion, can't punish it, but it can't do anything that would have any effect of promoting either a specific religion or religion in general. And if you quote around what he's saying there, if you just pull out a couple of sentences, you can make him sound like he's favoring some kind of official religion when that is exactly what he's not doing.
And that's Memorial and Remonstrance, that's where the famous threepence language, right?
Yeah. It says a government that can make you pay three pence towards the support of a religion can make you pay a lot more.
So he and was... Go ahead.
So, and throughout his career, Madison was very consistent about this. Throughout his career as a congressman, as Secretary of State, Vice President, President, he continually opposed anything that gave any kind of official sanction to either a specific denomination or to religion as opposed to non-religion. He opposed chaplains in Congress. He opposed chaplains in the Navy. He opposed giving any kind of federal land or time of federal officials to perform any religious functions. And it wasn't because he was anti-religion. He simply believed that religion was wholly separate from the social contract that we make with each other as members of a republic, and therefore that the people had to have an absolute right to their religion, and that the government had an absolute right simply not to take any, or the government had an absolute responsibility not to take any awareness of either a particular religion or of religion in general.
Which is neutrality, and we live in Madison, Wisconsin, of course, named for Madison, so that's kind of nice.
Yeah, and that's, you know, throughout the 20th century, the Supreme Court moved us much closer to that doctrine. It's not in place yet, but every time that it did, people would go back and say, well, that's not what the founders said. They said, and what they generally do is they'll grab a sentence here or a sentence there. You know, the king of this is this guy, David Barton.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Familiar with him?
The wall builders, the wall destroyer.
The wall builders, the Jefferson lies. He has a book called Original Intent, which is, it's a very frustrating book to read because it's just hundreds and hundreds of completely acontextualized quotations. This is what Benjamin Franklin said. This is what Thomas Jefferson said. This is what John Adams said. And those quotations he somehow suggests should be the way that we interpret the Constitution, even though three-fourths of the people he quotes in the book were nowhere near Philadelphia during the writing of the Constitution.
I like how you point out that there are some quotes that these people bring up, which actually prove the opposite, because they are quoting proposed legislation that was actually voted down. They're quoting things which our founders, if I can use that word, actually rejected. Can you give an example of something like that?
Well, the perfect example is during the congressional debates about the First Amendment. Both James Madison and... George Mason proposed versions that would have restricted the First Amendment Establishment Clause to establishing a specific denomination. George Mason proposed a version of the amendment which said that no Christian denomination shall be preferred over any other, but Christianity shall be the religion of the United States. And David Barton quotes that and says, this proves that this is what the founders intended. And it actually proves exactly the opposite. It proves what the founders didn't intend because they didn't vote for it.
Exactly. So actually that strengthens our case that they made a secular constitution, a constitution. I like that word non-cognizance. It fits nicely with the word neutrality.
Non-cognizance really is Madison's doctrine. And I think it's just a phenomenally simple way to approach questions of religion and church and state. Is the government taking any notice of religion? And if it is, then it violates Madison's non-cognizance doctrine.
Now, you also write about Jefferson's famous correspondence with the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut. Do you want to talk about that?
The probably no quote is more argued over than Jefferson's separation of church and state. And I've just seen some amazing interpretations from people on the right about what Jefferson was really saying. And, you know, David Barton says that he was telling the Baptists that they didn't ever have to worry about establishing a religion, a particular denomination, because America would always be non-denominational.
Hmm.
Pat Robertson actually has a book where he says that Jefferson was telling them he'd like to help them, but that darn First Amendment Establishment Clause means he can't.
And you hear this one quote, it was a two-way, they try to say Jefferson said it was a two-way street.
Two-way wall?
No, they just make up something.
Yeah, and it's completely made. I mean, the history is fairly clear. We've got some good documentary evidence of what Jefferson was doing, why he was writing this letter. And first of all, he wasn't writing a letter to the Danbury Baptists. He was using a letter from the Danbury Baptists to write an editorial for local newspapers. I mean, this was an open letter. And what he was trying to do was explain why he abandoned Washington and Adams' tradition of calling for days of fast. Days of fasting and Thanksgiving, which Washington and Adams both did. And he'd taken a lot of heat for being an atheist, and that was one of the main charges against him in 1800, was that he was an atheist, and this is why he wasn't proclaiming fast days, and this was a point that he wanted to go on record with. So he wanted to tell the Baptists, and he used the Danbury Baptists because this was a very conservative evangelical denomination, but nonetheless one that strongly supported religious neutrality because they were living in a state with an established church, congregational church.
We're out of time. Why don't you read what he said quickly, that it created what? A wall?
Created a wall of separation between church and state.
So, thank you, Michael
Thank
Austin.
You so much.
Michael is the author of the book, That's Not What They Meant. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. This show is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. If you want to know more about our radio show, go to ffrf.org/radio.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org. You can look up the editorials by the New York Times and Washington Post at ffrf.org/news. Go to FFRF in the news. You can phone us at 1-800-335-4021, and we'd love to have you join us in our work for separation of church and state. Tune in next week for more Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.